Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. I am joined once again by Harris Kupperman of Praetorian Capital. Harris, great to see you. How are you doing?
Doing great, Jack. It's good to be on.
I'm really glad you're here. So you're a fund manager. I think you recently got to over $340 million. So congratulations on that.
Thanks. It's been a long road.
Tell us about your view on the economy and inflation and bonds.
My view is the economy is doing just fine. I mean, if you're going to run a 7% fiscal deficit, the economy is great. Unfortunately, that creates a lot of inflation, and someone's got to fund those deficits. And I think we're running out of suckers. You have this problem where if you're going to run a 7% deficit, but you only pay people 4, yet inflation keeps ticking back up. They say, why am I paying 4 for 10 years? You know, like I want something more. I think we're going to see bonds at 6 or 7. And I don't think the world's ready for that. I don't think investors are ready for that. I don't think banks are ready for that. I don't think the real estate sector is ready for that. I think it's going to be a giant margin call, and I think it's going to be messy. I think it's really scary. And you see bonds really starting to roll over again as Jay Powell keeps talking about cutting rates while the CPI and all the other inflation data are screaming out of control. I don't know. I think they're going to have to raise rates again, and I don't think anyone's ready. I think it's going to be a giant mess.
Raise rates again. So the 10-year is now at 4.5%. You said 6 or 7%. So the financial world is not ready for that at all. Like maybe stocks will do okay if the economy is great, but the world's not ready for that.
Well, they can either reduce spending, but we know they're not going to do that. And you look at the two leading candidates as presidents, and they're both big spenders. So they're not going to do that. Congress is not going to do that. So we're going to keep spending. And if you keep spending at 7, well, that's roughly where the bond should be. That's just history. And so I think bonds are going to go lower. And that's what the charts tell me. And, you know, that's what the fund flows tell me. And that's where we're going.
And the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates to 5 3/8. And surprisingly, you know, indicated that they would cut this year with their dot plots. They indicated that in November. So the market, you know, going into this year expected 6 or even 7 rate cuts. And now it expects 2. And you think it will go further? I mean, you think the Federal Reserve will actually not just not cut, but you think they might even hike?
They might cut once or twice just to say they did it. But no, I think they're going to be raising rates. And as the bond crisis gets worse, I think they're going to, you know, start raising rates at a very rapid clip. I have this view that we're an emerging market, not a developed market anymore. And in a developed market, what happens is you get to have some, you know, control of your finances. In an emerging market, you don't. And when the bond market starts falling apart, you have to raise rates to bring capital back to your market. And you have to raise rates to slow the inflation. And I think we're going to play by emerging market rules this cycle, and I don't think anyone's ready for that. You know, as the bonds start cascading, Jay Powell has two, you know, things he could do. One is he could raise rates really rapidly again, you know, take rates to 7 or 8, but he's not going to do that because it's going to blow up everything. The other option, and I think the one he's going to do, is some version of yield curve control, which is what every country does when they get into this sort of crisis. They print money and they buy the long end to stabilize it. And that's very, very inflationary. And I think that's what they're going to end up doing, some version of that. And I think you're going to see them stabilize the bonds, not at 4.5, obviously. It'd be something like 6 or something. They'll draw a line where they say no more. They're going to print a ton of money. And every CUSIP, you know, equities are going to scream out of control. And, you know, that's the Project Zimbabwe world that I keep talking about. And I think first you might have a little bit of a messy crash and then you get there, or maybe you just go there directionally without you skip over the crash. I don't really know, but I definitely think we're going to get to a YCC sort of world.
Equity scream. When you said equity scream, higher or lower?
Higher. I mean, they just print money and it just goes into anything it can go into, but mostly it'll go into equities. I think you'll see a rotation, though, you know, out of the sort of things that are working now, like tech that is really overvalued. It'll go into things that do very well with inflation. So hard assets, energy, gold. I mean, look, gold's going up now pretty much every day. It's telling you that the smart money sees this coming.
Harris, I know that you've been a big inflationista for a long time, investing in hard assets, but I don't think of you as someone who is a massive gold bullet. In other words, you chose to express your inflationista thesis through other stuff. But it's my understanding now that you are allocated to gold in a big way. So, and I should say for our audience, you know, the price has exploded higher. It's broken well past 2,000, up, you know, well over 10% over the past month or so. Do you own gold? Gold miners? And I know there's a particular one company that has some gold exposure.
So I own the miners. I'm embarrassed to say I own the miners. You're never supposed to own the miners, right? They've destroyed tons of capital. It's kind of amazing. If you look at any mining index, you know, since I started in this business, gold was 300. Now it's 2,300. So call it almost 8x. And, you know, the miners gone nowhere. They've literally had zero correlations, zero leverage. They've just been terrible where gold has worked. But what I've learned is that during periods of time where gold's going up, you get these short windows, a couple of weeks, couple months, where gold really does outperform on a percentage basis the miners outperform gold on a percentage basis. They have real beta for these really short truncated periods. And so I own a collection of miners. I am not smart enough to choose which miner. I own the GDX and the GDXJ. They're both, you know, very liquid baskets of miners, and I'll let the guys at VanEck choose them for me, you know. And I own some other bits and pieces because I think I might be able to choose a few of them. But for the most part, that's my exposure to gold directly. I don't intend to own this long term. I'm already amazed I've owned it for as long as I've owned it.
Yeah, so it's fair to say gold has really broken out, but the gold mining stock, well, gold mining shares, they've gone up, but not by as much. And you think they've
done better in percent terms. They've actually done better. I mean, it's just that when you look at a chart, it doesn't look like anything because it went from kind of the bottom of the range to the middle of the range. They haven't really gone anywhere still. I think there's potential that they could really get going if people get excited. I think people have really taught themselves not to own gold miners, which is the right thing. But as the cycle gets going and people keep talking about gold, I think you will see people come into the miners. There's just no interest in it. I haven't seen a breakout of such a large and liquid asset, a big, large liquid asset like this, where it broke out to new highs, where there's been just no publicity, no attention given to it. It's strange. If you look at GLD or SLV, which are the two active gold and silver ETFs in the US, they've had almost no inflows. They've actually had mostly outflows this year. People are actually selling the move up. There's so much PTSD. So much capital has been frustrated owning the miners and owning gold over the last decade as it's gone nowhere. Well, it's worse than nowhere. It's gone violently sideways and just shaking people out. So no one wants to own these things. And as it moves up, no one's in it. It's really kind of surreal. But I know how this game works. And if it gets to be later in the year and gold keeps making new highs, you can't be an active manager and have missed such a large visible trade. And so I think money will start flowing in just because it has to flow in. They have to show that they own it. You know, who's buying it if no one's buying it? Well,
that's my question. Yeah.
Well, China, India, Russia, all the central banks are buying it. We've also seen, the Japanese retail ETF, they're buying it. But I mean, if I was trapped in Japanese yen, I'd want to, get some money out of the system. That goes down every day. And I think you're just seeing this around the world. People are realizing that paper money doesn't work. I mean, they've been talking about this. Let's be realistic. It's been 50 years they've been talking about this. But every once in a while, you get one of these periods in time where they print too much of it. And paper money starts devaluing against real assets. We call that inflation. And people reach for some more gold. And I think we're in one of those cycles right now. And I think, everyone should own some gold. It's not investment advice. It's just common sense.
You've also been very bullish on the price of oil. That is also rising as well. What are your views there, as well as how do you express your bullish view?
Well, I've been bullish oil for a while now, and it hasn't really worked for me. Oil's been 70 on the floor and kind of 90 on the ceiling for 2 years now. I don't know. I think it goes higher, but I've gotten it wrong for so long. I'm not sure I'm the expert on this. But what I have done, I think, well, is not really so much owning oil itself, but owning the service companies. As people start going out there looking for oil again, there's demand for services, especially offshore. And we own two companies that are serving the offshore industry. When shale became really dominant last decade, the market share of oil coming from offshore declined. And I think that market share is going to grow now. There's been a lot of really massive discoveries in Guyana, Namibia, all over Brazil, just all over offshore. And I think these are low cost and just really high ROIC deposits. And I think you're going to see a lot more demand for this equipment. Drill rates have gone from, let's call it, for a modern drill ship from 150,000 a day 2 years ago to around 500,000 a day. I think it goes higher. And that's a whole lot of profitability for these companies. But I own Valaris. They're the largest owner of offshore drilling equipment globally. They trade very cheaply. It's actually a very large position for us. We own some Tidewater as well. They're one of the largest players in service vessels offshore. They've done very well, but it seems really cheap still. But that's how I'm playing my gold. I own some call options. I still own my December 2025 100 calls. I recently bought some 90s as well. I feel like they're going to get into the money. You know, I still have a year and change to see it through. I think it's timed well for after the election. I think they're going to continue to intervene and dump SPR and do things to keep oil down into the election. But after the election, it's a free game. And I think oil is going to go up because the demand keeps going up and they're not really producing much more of it.
When you talk about the offshore names, how do you value those stocks? And what kind of price to earnings ratio? How cheap are they?
So we're at the part of the cycle, and I hate to use the different metrics, but at this part of the cycle, I think you really need to think about it in terms of replacement cost. You're buying steel. The earnings come later in the cycle, because if you're Valaris, you're now servicing contracts you signed in 2021 and 2022. These signed at almost no EBITDA. You signed them just because you wanted to get your equipment working again, because otherwise it just sits there rusting. And so they signed these contracts at, you know, at the time were, you know, market rates, but they're now way below market. And as they start, as they continue to sign at current rates, you're going to see a lot more cash flow come through. So I think, you know, looking forward to say 2025, you're at a low single digit cash flow multiple, but on current numbers, there's really not much in the way of cash flow and EBITDA. And what they do have really just goes into paying for the mobilization of the remaining equipment that's not mobilized. I think it's way better to look at this on a replacement cost basis. So Valaris trades at about 10% of the replacement cost of the equipment based on, you know, my estimation of what it would cost if you were to go to a Korean yard and order a, you know, seventh gen drill ship. But you would never actually go and order a drill ship because it would cost you, you know, north of $1 billion to get the drill ship. It's going to take, you know, 5 years to be delivered. And you could buy an existing drill ship for, I don't know, $200-300 million today. So why would you go order a new one? It just doesn't make any sense. Obviously, you know, they're going to use up the existing ones and the price will have to go up. You have to get the economics up to a level where, it, you know, you actually get a payback on that $1 billion piece of equipment. So we're very, very early in this cycle. And that's why, you know, this trades at 10% of replacement cost still. At the top of the cycle, it goes to something like 1.5 to 2 times replacement cost, because that's what incentivizes people to go actually order. If you're the CEO of a company and you can order a piece of equipment for $1 billion and it shows up, and suddenly, you know, it's worth 2 times. So your enterprise value, you know, increases by $2 billion, but you only paid $1 billion for it. Well, then you can do it as many times as you possibly can. And that's why you end up with a glut at the end of the cycle. But we're early in this process, you know, and no one's ordering.
So a lot of the contracts are still making money at those depressed 2020, 21 rates. And it takes a while for those rates to reset. Kind of like banks, you know, rising rates are good for banks. But so, you know, so many banks are still getting paid 3% from the mortgages they got in 2020.
It takes a long time for these to reset. But, you know, in the case of Valaris, they have a lot of contracts that are resetting in the back half of this year. So I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. And it finally gets to the point that in 2025, you start making money. And then it looks even better in 26.
Got it. So assuming a 500,000 day rate or higher rates, what if then you'll see, start to see the earnings. Sorry, did you say what kind of multiple that would be trading at now? Or
it'd be like 2 times cash flow.
Okay.
But that's where they're signing the contracts right now. So, yeah, you know, you just need to wait a little bit. And they've told you they're going to use it all on buybacks. So, well, maybe some dividends too, but it's mostly we use the buybacks. It's going to be really, really accretive. I mean, the guys running the company are smart. And if you could buy something at 10 cents of the dollar, you're going to do that as much as you can. But they need to wait until they get to the part with the cash flow. And there's still a 6-month window before you get that cash flow. I think it's interesting because what we saw with Tidewater, which is another stock we own, because of the cycle. So in offshore drilling, you know, you're looking at longer term contracts. So it takes 2-3 years to roll the contracts over. In the case of OSVs, you know, you have a lot more spot market. You have a lot of stuff that's 6 month, 3 month, some 1 year contract. The average duration is, you know, almost a year. So it's rolled over faster. And you've seen the stock just perform dramatically better because they're now reporting earnings. I think, you know, Q4 that they reported was the first with some actual earnings. And then I think as you get into this year and, you know, especially the summer, you're going to see some real, real cash flow show up. And it's going to be the first time that it's shown cash flow really since like 2014. You know, it went through bankruptcy and everything. But people can see the cash flow. You can see it building. You can see the contract. And they're telling you where the leading day rate is. But until you actually get to it, you cycle through it, Wall Street doesn't care. And then when Wall Street cares, the stock just goes and goes and goes. I mean, look at a chart of it.
Why did you choose Valaris and Tidewater versus some of the other offshore names, which I presume you might be bullish on because you're bullish on the overall sector, but you're less bullish than on the names you invested in, obviously?
I want to buy the cheapest equipment, and I think management matters a lot. I want to partner with the best people, the guys who I think just operate best. But for me also, I want to own clean balance sheets. I know that these are cyclical companies. I know that no one can predict the price of oil, as I've proven to myself. And I want to make sure that if I'm wrong, I don't get hurt badly. You know, if you have a clean balance sheet with not a lot of debt, then you're going to be okay. You're going to be able to outlive the other guy. There's a lot of guys that are in weaker positions. But also, this is a scale business. You have some fixed corporate cost. And you want to amortize that on as many vessels as you can. And the smaller guys, when you look at it on SGA per unit, they're just not cost competitive. You really want to be with the biggest players in this industry. Because you know, if you're going to be operating across the globe, you need to have people stationed in multiple countries. It just costs a lot of money to do that. And it's difficult. And you know, you just need a lot of equipment to make it make sense. So I went with the two biggest.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the VanEck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview. Got it. All right. So now, Cuppy, let's talk about a commodity that has exploded higher and that you've been, you know, very right to be bullish on, and something that, you know, I wish I could say that I've interviewed a lot of people and they've been bullish on it. I think you probably said something in our previous interview probably about a year ago, but I'm talking about uranium, which is up a tremendous amount. What is your thesis there? Why has it gone up so much? How long can it last? Do you remain bullish?
Well, of course I'm bullish. It's my one of my favorite ideas. I got bullish on uranium in 2021 because it was obvious that there was a supply-demand mismatch. And I think I've been lucky in many ways in that some trades, you know, you get really optimistic and it doesn't work like you expect it to. Something happens, something changes. It's you get unlucky, right? And sometimes you just get extra lucky. And in the case of uranium, I think we've gotten really lucky in that it's become seen as a green energy source globally. And a lot of power plants that we thought in our model were going to, you know, get shut down at the 40-year or 50-year window, they got contract extensions. We've seen the Japanese bring power plants back online. We didn't expect that. We've seen other power plants, come back to life that we thought were, going to be, scrapped. It's just turned out better than we could have ever imagined. At the same time, we've seen Kazakhstan, which is the largest producer, having real production issues. And so the deficit numbers, the wedge we had originally built turned out to be fatter and longer. It's great. And I think this year we're going to have a deficit of about 50 million pounds on about 210 of demand. It's crazy. It's almost 25%. You know, if we were doing 25 million barrels of oil deficit, I mean, I'd be retired now. it's just crazy what we're seeing in uranium, and people don't know where the pounds come from. You know, next year, I don't think it really changes. If anything, the deficits get worse, because it does seem like Kazakhstan has real production issues. And despite a lot of people that have announced mines coming online, it takes a while to build a mine. And it never comes online on budget, on time, it never hits the nameplate number. There's a lot of restarts, but they take years also. I mean, a lot of these restarts, they're starting it now. It's 27, 28 before you really get any real production. That's years in this industry. And meanwhile, you're going to be 50 million pounds a year drawing down. And I don't know where those pounds come from. I really don't. And I don't think a lot of the utilities have thought this through very well. You know, they just are of the view that you call your broker when you need pounds and pounds magically show up. And one day pounds don't show up and then there's a panic. And I think we're nearing the panic phase.
It's not like oil where there's spare capacity where they can turn on at a moment. It's going to take a while to increase production is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while. No one's even really increasing production right now. I mean, the largest producer is missing their targets. It's a world of trouble. And at the same time, you have a number of investment vehicles. And you know, for disclosure, we're long Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. We're long Yellowcake. Those are our main ways of playing uranium. They're out there buying pounds. They're tightening the market and making the supply demand imbalance even worse if you think of it that way. And they're going to keep front running these utilities. And eventually, it's just going to be fewer pounds to go around. Especially if they just keep buying pounds as it stays in the news.
So you don't own uranium miners, but you do own a lot of uranium.
I own a lot of uranium. Yes.
How much uranium in terms of pounds? How many pounds of uranium do you own?
Well, I think it's more than 1 million pounds.
Wow. And so why have you been long the physical commodity rather than the miners? Because this mine in Kazakhstan, it makes so much of the uranium in the world, and it is ridiculously profitable. Unfortunately, it's quite close to Russia. But why not own the uranium miners? Which, if you're so bullish on uranium, they should make money, right?
Well, they sold forward a lot of their production. I think the price of uranium will do something that looks like the Eiffel Tower. It'll go straight up and then straight down, because eventually, if you take the price up high enough, you figure out how to produce more of it, and then there'll be an epic glut of it again. And I don't want to own the producers that sold most of their pounds at $70, because I don't get that upside to the spike. I'm sure the shares will go up because, people don't do any research and they hear the word uranium, they just buy the ETF and the ETF then buys the shares. But for me, I want to do the thing that doesn't take any risk. And I mean, look, Cameco is a producer. They've sold forward their pounds. It's really expensive on an earnings basis. Kazatomprom did something similar. It's also in a bad neighborhood, so it's not going to get a multiple. And there's no other miners. There's a lot of companies that call themselves miners, but they don't mine anything.
Really? Yeah. I mean, there are companies that, I won't name names, but it's like they've been public for 15 years. They've never made uranium. They're buying uranium. They're not selling it. They're buying it.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy when you think about it. But look, that tightens the market. And, some of these companies have made a lot of money buying uranium, holding it, and seeing it appreciate. That's a lot more profitable than actually mining. Mining's hard. I mean, I don't want to mine. I just want to own this stuff.
Why have there been producers have had trouble getting it onto market? Like I don't know how to pronounce it, but the Kazakhstani producer, the price of uranium has gone from a little over $20 to 100, and now it's at 88. I feel like if you and I were working at this uranium mine and we owned the mine, we'd be pretty incentivized to get more uranium out of the ground. What's going on?
Well, I think they are incentivized. It's just hard. Mining is hard. It's very capital intensive. It's a giant engineering project, and things just don't go as you expect. In the case of Kazakhstan, they're having issues where there's not enough sulfuric acid. The way they mine in Kazakhstan is they pump sulfuric acid underground. It gets pregnant with uranium. They bring it to the surface, and they extract the uranium. And because they've overproduced a lot of their deposits, it's depleted, they need more and more acid just to run in place. And as a result, a lot of these mines are nearing the end of their mine life. And so you have to put 2, 3, 4 times as much acid as previously. And there's just not enough acid in the whole country to make the thing work. And, they're scouring the globe for this stuff. They're building an acid plant. But you need one engineering project to solve the problems in a different engineering project. It all takes time and capital. And, the world has neither of those right now, especially in Kazakhstan.
Tell us more about the spot market and the variety of ETFs or products that allow investors to get exposure to physical uranium, actual uranium, because it seems like a lot of the market is owned by investors.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I think the spot market is a fake market in many ways. Like, a spot market doesn't really mean anything. I'm not joking. It's literally a WhatsApp group. Like, literally a WhatsApp group. I mean, every once in a while, I reach out to a friend who's a broker and he sends me a screenshot of the thing. And, you know, if you're a utility and you want some pounds, you call up your broker and your broker says, hey, I need 100,000 pounds for this delivery location. Who's got it? And maybe a day or two later, someone says, hey, I might have 100,000 pounds. You know, what's your price? Okay, this is my price. And it just sits there. And sometimes it goes a week or two without a transaction. And then a trade happens. And then everyone's like, oh, the spot price moved, you know, $3. Well, not really. I mean, the bid ask was $2, $3, $4. And, you know, sometimes, you know, there's an offer and the offer cancels or, you know, the bid cancels. It's a very abstract concept. You know, other markets, a lot of it happens in the spot market. In the Iranian market, it mostly happens in the term market. And the spot market is where excess pounds are disposed of or excess pounds are acquired when someone needs something they didn't plan for. And so the vast majority of the trading doesn't happen in the spot market. And what you see in the spot market, honestly, isn't producers selling or utilities buying. It's a lot of hedge funds trading with each other. It's kind of a weird thing that you have a couple dozen hedge funds that opened custody accounts, and they're all, you know, buying and selling for each other. A lot of them bought it, you know, lower, and they're taking some chips off the table. Other guys are buying here, you know, at 85, 90, and, you know, they want to, you know, ride the next wave. And that's what you see. And then you see guys who are making a market, you know, they're buying it at one price. They're trying to flip it for a dollar profit. It's a good business too. And, but it's not a traditional market that you would see where it's producers and consumers. This is finance guys really doing finance guys stuff.
It's a really interesting market. So how high do you think it goes?
It's hard to say, right? You need it because otherwise you have a multi-billion dollar power plant that doesn't work. So it's not like you can, you know, plug something else in. It's not like where you have nat gas and, you know, if nat gas goes up, you use coal. And if that goes up, you use heating oil. There's always a way. It doesn't work that way in uranium. And so there really is no price. I mean, if it went to 1,000, it would change the cost of electricity so marginally. There's no price that is too high, which makes it really interesting, I think, for someone like me as a speculator. You know, do I think it goes to 1,000? I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem like the right price here at 85, though.
You said it's no price. It would only increase electricity for the consumer a little bit, but I presume the utilities at some point would start to feel the pain in the same way that European utilities felt the pain when natural gas spiked.
Not really, because the vast majority of utilities are using term contracts. So they have a term contract they signed a few years ago, and the term contract said, okay, there's a floor at 50, there's a ceiling at 70. They've already locked the thing in. So if the price goes to 1,000, they pay 70. And if their, you know, utility needs a million pounds a year and they need to buy an extra 100,000 pounds, well, it takes the average up, but it's not like they're paying 1,000 across the board. They, you know, under budgeted and they just need an extra 100,000 pounds for the enrichment process or something. Well, they pay whatever the price they pay is because they've locked in the other 90% of what they need at a much lower price. So it's not really going to filter through to anyone. I mean, the only guys who are going to be buying and selling it are probably other speculators like me. You know, if someone goes into SPUT and buys shares, then SPUT has to go buy pounds. That's just the way the trust is designed, right? So if it starts going up, and, you know, I think it will start going up, then people will buy more shares like the last cycle, and then SPUT will buy more pounds. And, you know, you'll have some of these physical guys that bought it lower. They'll sell it to SPUT, or maybe they'll, you know, keep it. I don't know. But you're going to see just small little bits of trading that move the price. It's going to be finance guys moving it with the occasional utility showing up.
But if you think the spot price is going to explode higher, don't you think that there will be a point where the contract price goes up? In other words, what happens when all of the speculators own so much of the spot market keeps on going up and up and up, and a utility wants to buy uranium? What happens then?
Well, yeah, then they'll have to pay a higher price. But I mean, these guys aren't stupid, right? So if you know that in 2030, a bunch of mines will be online by then, and there'll be a bunch of supply, then if the price is 1,000 and it's 2027, let's say, and you go and say, I want pounds delivered in 2033, well, you're not going to pay 1,000 for it. You're going to negotiate something where you lock in pounds at some number that's really attractive to the mining company, but it's not 1,000. It's not crazy. And it'll be a way below market transaction. I mean, the term market is a much more slower moving market than the spot market. The spot market is a leading market. It spikes, it pulls back, it spikes. The term market goes very slow and gradual. And I just don't think guys will be paying that. I keep using the word 1,000. I don't know if that's where it goes. I hope it goes. I mean, if it went to just 200, I'd be pretty happy too.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it already has gone up a tremendous amount, and 1,000 would be 10x from here. So that is, 200 is that would still be a very, very big move.
Yeah, baby steps.
Yeah, baby steps. Let's go back to gold, because I know, so you own some of the gold miners. You said you own GDX, GDXJ, but you also own, and I think recently disclosed, one position in a single company. And actually, you disclosed that you own a large, you pulled a Warren Buffett move and made a disclosure that you own a certain amount. Was it 5% of the company? What is the name of the company? Why are you so involved with it? And why did you decide to take such a large position?
Well, we own about 6%. When you go above 5%, you have to file. I wish I didn't, but I have to. And since everyone knows I own it, I might as well tell people why I own it, right? Because they're going to get it out of me anyway. The company's AMARK. Ticker is AMRK. We own a lot of shares, so we're a little biased. Do your own work, obviously. But this is my favorite idea in my book right now. I just love this idea. The problem with gold, and we talked about this before, gold mining is a terrible business. It's just, it's terrible. And everyone's looking for a way to have leverage, you know, leverage to gold, but there's really no leverage anywhere. You can buy futures, but leverage cuts both ways and no one wants to be levered on a down day. You could buy options, but my timing is terrible. I don't want to do options. You can buy the miners. We already discussed why they're terrible. You could buy royalty companies, which everyone seems to just be infatuated with right now, but they're just a different way of owning a mining company. You reduce your risk in some ways. Like, you're not as focused on the cost of production, and you just get your ounces or pounds, no matter what it is. But you're still taking geopolitical risk. I mean, Franco-Nevada just learned that in Panama. You're still taking geology risk. You never really know what's under the ground until you go underground. It's still really, really risky. And these things trade at silly multiples on earnings, which I don't think are justified in any way. And so we've been trying to figure out how else do you get exposure. And this company, AMARK, just came to us, actually came through a friend. And they're one of the largest coin dealers in North America and now Hong Kong. They own the JM Bullion brand. If you've ever bought coins through JM Bullion, you bought it from them. But they own a bunch of other brands as well. They're about one third of the market right now. It's effectively a duopoly with them and APMEX. But they're about one third of all the coins sold in North America. That they also do wholesale business. So if you go to your local coin dealer on the corner shop, there's a very good chance they're buying coins from AMARK as well. They also have their own mints. They're minting coins. They own the Silvertown Mint and Sunshine. It's just a really, really good business. I mean, this is a business where from 2021 to 23, fiscal, 3 years in a row, they earned $7 a share. Stock's trading about $40 right now. I bought mine cheaper, but it's still really cheap in my mind. We haven't sold any. But they earned $7 a share for 3 years in a row. They gave it back to you in special dividends and buybacks, and they kept buying up, competition. They just continue to consolidate the industry. It's a really, really good business. So then why was it cheap? Well, if you think of the way the world's been working, this is a play on two things: volumes, how many coins get bought each year, and the spread above a spot. And, when you go buy a gold coin, it's $100 more than the spot price, and you get all mad. Well, who do you think is getting that $100? It's these guys, right? And that spread fluctuates. And at times when there's a lot of demand, the spread widens. And when demand declines, the spread drops. And, we've seen this be reasonably well correlated to what's happening in GLD and SLV. And we've already talked about how there's been net outflows from those two trusts now for the better part of, really 2 years. And so, when there's no demand for that, well, there's not a lot of demand to go to AMARK and go buy gold coins and silver coins. I think now that the price of gold's going up, making new highs almost every day, silver's going up as well, making multi-year highs, people are going to start buying coins because it's in the news and it's going up. And I know that Americans love things that are going up. And so I think you're going to see demand grow. If you look at web data, you've seen the demand start coming back. The web data is usually a pretty good indicator of how the sales trends are doing. We've also seen the spreads start to inch up a little. And as the spreads grow, I think the earnings grow. If you look at it, they're at a run rate right now about $2.50 to $3 a year. So it's not cheap. It's not really expensive on that sort of multiple. But I think, I can go back to earning seven. I think I can make 10 bucks a share, honestly. And I think that as people realize this is a really high return on capital way to own exposure to gold and silver and, basically bet on people being scared and buying coins, I still trade at a much higher multiple. The royalty companies are 40, 50 times earnings. why can't this be 25 times earnings? And if they earn $10 a share, why can't it be 250? I'm not saying that's a price target. I don't do price targets, but I'm saying why not? It seems kind of logical to me.
Why was it that it earned $10 a share over the past 3 years, like per year?
It earned $7 a share 3 years in a row. And there's a lot of adjustments you have to make. So Look at the financials. That's adjusting out for some intangibles amortization and some one-time stuff. Like, you know, you have to go through the numbers. But I'm pretty comfortable in saying that it did seven a year.
And so why was it making more money when the price of gold was lower than it is now?
Well, it was making more money because there was a lot more demand. You can literally see the spikes if you look at the web traffic. And every time something crazy happened in the world, people panicked and bought gold. So you had COVID, you had lockdowns, you had riots, you had all the election chaos and Jan 6. I mean, you had Russia invade Ukraine, you had Silicon Valley. And you could literally see, it's like an EKG. It's kind of flat and then spike, you know, a couple of weeks, just spike. And then it comes back down again. And then another crazy thing happens, a spike. And we've just had a 9-month period where nothing too crazy has happened. And honestly, right now, gold keeps making new highs, but everyone's chasing Bitcoin and dog with hat. And, you know, they're buying their NVIDIA. And so you just haven't seen the inflows of demand. I mean, look, they're still selling a lot of coins. I mean, just to understand the scale of this, they sold over 2 million ounces of gold last year and something like 145 million ounces of silver. This is like a big, meaningful company. It's $9 billion in revenue. They're still selling a lot, but it's trailed off a little.
Harris, what do you think about artificial intelligence as well as the impact on the profitability of certain stocks? Do you think that the rally because of AI is justified?
I don't know anything about AI. I'm the last person to ask. We don't look at technology stocks. We don't try to, you know, guess about the future of AI. It's so far removed from what I know. We buy cash flow. We buy hard assets. We buy easy to value things. We keep it really, really simple around here. And as a result, I think we've done really well. But we really don't try to do anything fancy. I'm sure there's people you could reach out to that know so much about AI. I tried ChatGPT for about an hour. I'm just like, okay, this is kind of nice. But I don't know what to do with it.
It's good that you find your circle of competence when you put things in the too hard pile and you invest in stuff that is easy to value. What would you say is the product or company that you are invested in that is the easiest to value? Like this, it's the simplest possible thing. You could write it on, you know, a notepad.
Oh, I mean, we own a lot of shares of St. Joe. It's the easiest to value because they just own land. They own property. They own hotels. I mean, it's easy to figure out exactly what it's worth because there's transactions on a pretty regular basis and you can just figure out what the thing is worth. You know, you're going to have a range. It's going to be a sort of wide range, but net asset value is somewhere between 200 and 300 a share. Like that's the number. And I don't think you can be any more precise. You know, it's just like my house on a good day might have one number and a bad day might have a different number. I kind of know what the range. What's the range? It's super easy. It's not like you have to go out there. Well, I guess you can do this on stocks too. You know, here's the earnings number and then you put a multiple on it. You kind of have a range. The problem is a lot of the stuff I invest in tends to be stuff that is unloved because it's under-earned, like Valaris, where the earnings are 2 years in the future. So you can't just look at that earnings number. Even though you have contracts can be broken. Things can happen. It's harder, you know, but that's why the mispricing exists.
What do you mean contracts can be broken?
Well, I mean, you have a contract with a company and they can cancel the contract on you. They'll pay a penalty, obviously. And it depends how well the contract is written and what your clauses are and what the outs are. But we've seen all sorts of contracts get canceled when pricing declines. But also, you know, you have a duty to perform. And if your drill ship isn't to spec, well, then you're going to cancel the contract on them and pay them penalties. And so you don't see a lot of contracts get canceled, but at the end of the cycle, you do. And unfortunately, with a sector like this, you never really know when the end of the cycle is. That's why you sell too soon. But I feel like very much we're at the early part of the cycle. Just when you see how many projects are getting greenlit and how much capital is looking to go into offshore.
Harris, what have you made of the return of Bitcoin and the rise of it to new all-time highs?
I'm lost. I don't get it. I really don't get it.
What did you think of the previous move up in 2021? Did you have a thesis back then?
Yeah, I thought it was a Ponzi scheme. We owned it. We made a lot of money. As soon as Grayscale went to a discount to spot, we sold because the Ponzi scheme ended. This cycle, we saw inflows. We bought it. It went up. We sold it too soon. We made a bunch of money again. It's a Ponzi scheme. I don't understand why it has value, but it does. And it trades a lot, and there's a lot of participants in it. And I get that it's valuable to people. I mean, you could say the same thing about gold, too. It has Ponzi economics. It has no actual functional use. It's just a number with a lot of people involved. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I'd much rather own the thing that the Chinese, the Japanese, the, you know, the Russians are buying. You know, I want to own that as opposed to the thing that, you know, my Uber driver keeps trying to pump all the time. You know, that's usually not the thing you want to own.
But you did participate on the long side, not only in the last cycle, but this one currently. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. No, it was good for me. I wish I'd held longer, but it was good for me.
Nice. What are the approach necessary for investing in something that you perceive as a Ponzi? You know, I'm not saying Bitcoin is a Ponzi, but basically the, something like a greater fool theory. Oh, I want to buy this and sell it to someone else before speculative value, as opposed to, you know, I presume you want a mark. Obviously, if a share goes over its intrinsic value, you're going to sell it. But you do it. You have a fundamental thesis on it, where it sounds like you did not have a fundamental thesis for Bitcoin.
Well, something like Amark, look, you have cash flow, you have earnings. Every day, it's worth a little bit more because they've retained earnings. And they're going to pay me those earnings in dividends. I've earned a good chunk of dividends already in the year I've owned it. They've had some buybacks. They're going to buy more things. They're going to just keep creating value. It's something you can analyze. You know that I wake up in the morning tomorrow, it's going to be worth a little bit more. In the case of a Ponzi scheme, there's nothing wrong with playing Ponzi schemes. I've been playing them my whole life. You have to know that you want to buy early and you want to sell before the top. Ponzi schemes are inherently unstable. They can inflate or they can deflate. There's no such thing as equilibrium. It just doesn't last very long. You want to buy it when the chart looks good and no one's really talking about it. And you want to sell it when everyone's talking about it. You know, when my Uber driver is telling me how great it is, then it's time to sell. It's past the time to sell. You know, I was just in Barbados a week and a half ago. It's a little island in the middle of nowhere. Every single person I met there was busy with crypto, the waiters, the bartenders. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's not a very wealthy country. It's not a poor country. But everyone put all their savings into all sorts of coins I've never even heard of. That's what you see at the top. That's not what you see, you know, at the early stages of one of these bubbles. Doesn't mean it can't go a lot further, but it's not the part of the cycle I want to be involved in.
What else in the market do you see that you think is a Ponzi scheme?
Lots of things.
Like what?
Like the whole bond market. I think that's the one that's about to blow. I think we're going to see a real big crisis when fixed income markets detonate in the coming year or two. You know, our entire financial system was designed over a 30-year period where interest rates continue to go lower, where inflation rates continue to go lower. And now we're going the other way, and it's all in like suspended disbelief because these things reset slowly. You know, if you have commercial real estate and you underwrote it at 3 cap and it's now worth a 6 cap, well, then, you know, you've lost half your money. But if you did it at you know, any sort of LTV that had been done at any point in the last 5 years, 10 years, well, then, you know, you owe more than the thing is worth. And even then, like, even if you put more equity into it, you can't fund it because, I mean, your interest rates can be higher than your cash flow. The whole thing is upside down and everyone's like Wile E. Coyote off the cliff with their feet running around still, praying that interest rates decline. And they're looking at the, you know, duration left and they're like, okay, I got 2 years left until I have to refi this. I have time. I have 18 months left. J-Pal, you got to do something. Now I got 12 months left. Jake, you got to do something. Come on. And I'd eventually you're going to have to refi the thing. And I don't know how it's going to work. I mean, we've seen so far that banks have been supportive, I guess is the word you'd use, because no one wants to have bad debts. They've found creative ways to extend and pretend. But you can't extend and pretend on your entire asset ledger as a bank. It just doesn't work. And at some point, I think it's going to, you know, be a problem. And I don't know how it looks, but I think it's going to be really, really messy. Banking crises are messy. Financial crises are messy. And no one's ready for a dramatically higher interest rate world. It just hasn't hit yet. It's coming.
You said banking crises are messy. Are you forecasting or thinking of a banking crisis now? When we spoke exactly 1 year ago or around a year ago, the banks were going through some issues. You were very, very confident in saying that you didn't think that the failure of Silicon Valley Bank would be systemic. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, I was definitely correct about that. I think you said something to the effect of like, you know, they just hold deposits for the dog walking apps.
That's what they did. I mean, you have a bank that is it's one of the largest banks in the United States. It failed. And the next day, everyone woke up and said, who were they again? You know, like it totally didn't matter. They literally just facilitated the dog walking app startups. That's it.
Yeah, a lot of those startups. But yeah, I mean, either you could say it wasn't that economically sensitive, or the economy was so strong that, you know, there's no recession. Right now, we've not had a recession.
Right. And the economy's so strong right now, I think we're going to muddle through it. I think there's a lot of banks that if you look at them, they're insolvent right now. You know, take New York City Bank, you know, it's just the latest one that's in trouble. I mean, it's insolvent, right? It has negative value. They probably need 10 billion more. They put a billion in, they probably need like 10 billion more. You know, we looked at it, we spent a lot of time on it. It's insolvent, but they can keep the things going, Wile E. Coyote in the air for a couple more years. And, you know, every 6 months, every year, they're going to do another capital raise and keep the thing going. And they keep it going as long as guys are willing to keep it going. But they're in a world of trouble over there. And as they start trying to roll a lot of these mortgages forward, a lot of the debt they have in New York City forward, it's not going to work, because not only do you have to are they getting squeezed on net interest margin, but then all the people who are borrowing from them, they can't pay more because they can't raise rents. I'm going to see this in all sorts of rents where, you know, there's a lot of commercial real estate in the U.S. that has 10-year leases, 20-year leases. Like, how is this going to work? You can't, you know, roll the rental levels higher. Like, the asset just, you know, devalues. It's going to be a really messy, screwed up place. I think there's going to be a lot of banks that really suffer. I think there's going to be a lot of banks that do great because they have very minimal duration. It's going to be a great opportunity if you know financials. I'm not the guy who knows financials, but there are guys out there I think will have amazing, amazing years.
So do you not think, though, that there will be a equilibrium effect where higher interest rates cause problems in the financial economy and in the real economy, and they constrain economic activity? And therefore, because there's problems, inflation comes down, growth comes down, and therefore interest rates could go down as well. And it's kind of, you know, every time you go to the top of the range, as interest rates rise, the economy slows, and then interest rates fall, and those low rates create the next boom, and so on and so forth.
No, I think this is going to be more of a straight line. I think what will happen is banks are going to look at their asset ledger and look at their funding costs, which keep going up as interest rates go up. And they're going to say, well, we have to lend more to bring our average yield higher. And they're going to be aggressive in lending to, you know, higher interest rate things that are probably lower credit worthy, just to bring their average yield up so they can, you know, match it to their funding cost. I lived in Mongolia for a decade. I saw how this happened in real time. You would have thought that when they got themselves into trouble and they raised interest rates, the economy would slow. And instead, all the banks went on a crazy lending spree because they had to bring their average yield higher. And, you know, having seen this once, and if you look at what's happening right now with bank lending in the U.S., where it's recovering and no one expects it to recover, that everyone's doing the exact same thing. So the money supply is growing, economic activity is accelerating, and I think they're going to somehow or another muddle their way through the whole mess. You know, if you lost a bunch of banks, I don't think it's going to matter really, because it's a commodity product. You lose one, someone else takes the piece. It doesn't really matter unless, you know, you own shares that one bank.
A bunch of small or regional banks. You're not talking about Citi or JP Morgan falling, something like that.
I don't know. Maybe one of them could fall too. I don't really know. I haven't really gone too deeply into it. But I mean, we have a couple thousand banks in this country. We don't need that many. I think a bunch of them are going to fail because they don't have the right duration, you know, matching to their funding costs, or they've made loans that make no sense, you know, in a higher interest rate world. But I think it's going to be slow and methodical, and you're not going to have any of these like free fall collapses like Silicon Valley. It's going to look more like NYCB, where it just kind of, it's like an ice cube on the sidewalk. It melts away to nothing. But it takes a while, you know? And I think it's going to be a lot more like that. I think you're going to see a lot of commercial real estate in trouble too. You're going to see a lot of guys that have a thin sliver of equity, and the bank's going to own it, and the bank's going to sell it to another guy. And it's just going to be a messy work through process. But I don't think you're going to see like a banking crisis like 08. Like, I don't expect something like that. I think it's going to be more just of a muddle with banks doing a lot of business, quite honestly, on the lending side to get their average yield higher. I think that's why it's going to be very inflationary. Inflationary cycles just feed on themselves. And, you know, you have this weird sine curve thing where, you know, things go up in the inflation level and it levels out and it rolls over a little as businesses adjust. And then something else, you know, breaks and it goes again. And I think we're, you know, on the ascendancy again in terms of inflation rate. And, you know, it's going to be accelerated by the banks saying, hey, look, I can lend money at 8% and let's do it. Let's do a lot of it, you know, and guys take that money and they put it to work. Because if nominal GDP is 7, you fund it at 8, okay, it's not ideal. But, you know, you can probably outperform 8 just because your nominal revenue is going 7. And so I think you're going to see this when interest rates first spiked and guys said, for a small business loan, I got to pay 8 for this? No way, I'm not doing it. Now that it's 2 years later, they're like, yeah, why not? You know, it's just like this acceptance. And we've seen this also in housing. When mortgages mm-hmm. went to 8, everyone, you know, the whole housing economy froze. And now gradually people are saying, okay, it's been 2 years. You know, my friend did one at 8. You know, my cousin did one at 8. I guess I'll do one at 8 now. You know, I was hoping for 2.5. Well, it's not that world. I'll refi if it goes back to 2.5. But, you know, I just had 2 kids and I got to go. And I think we're seeing that everyone's just kind of accepting it. And the economy slowed for a bit when they took rates up. And now everyone's saying, okay. And that's why, you know, the Fed's going to have to take rates up a whole nother time if they want to slow it. It's, you know, it wasn't enough.
It's interesting. Well, Harris, thanks so much for coming on Forward Guidance. Tell us where people can find you. And I know you've got a lot of different websites.
I do.
And you've also got a research product as well. So tell us where people can find you.
Well, you can find me at praycap.com. I have a blog there. I write my comments. I write my thoughts. You can go to Twitter or X or whatever they call themselves this week and go to @HCuppy. You know, you'll probably unsubscribe though, because I'll probably offend you at some point. But if you stick around long enough, you'll enjoy some memes.
Thanks, Harris. Talk soon, and thanks everyone for watching.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/hodlfg to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.